This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show Series 6, Episode 43. Forget the Chimp. Coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, we talk about building relationship with players and how you have to forget about the chimp mind if you want to get through to the human mind. We'll find out what that's all about on this week's show. Plus, we help one player lose weight and another player set a field for a leg spin bowler in a 50-over match. All that and more coming up on this week's Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. Welcome to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show, your guide, of course, to better cricket, whether that's playing it or coaching it, whatever part of the cricket world you're involved with, we're here to help you out. And we, of course, are three people. My name is David Hinchliffe, I look after things. And joining me on the line, as they always do, is first of all, the Director of Cricket Coaching at Millfield School. It's Mark Garraway. Hello, Garris.
How are you? You okay?
Yes, very good, thanks. Yep, it's my head is full of gangsters at the moment because I've started reading the Godfather book. So that's what I'm doing quality. On my free time. The scene with the horse and horse's head was an interesting one, but we won't talk about that today. What we will talk about is cricket, and helping us do that is the third member of the team. It's the cricket professional at Portsmouth Grammar School. It's Sam Lavery. Hello, Lavers.
Hello, David. Sounds like you've got some interesting reading at the moment.
Oh, yes. It's gripping stuff. But anyway, let's not do our book review this week. I'll let you know what it's like when I've finished it. We'll come back to it another week. And let's instead talk about cricket. Because we're all cricket coaches here, so one of the things that has interested me in recent times is building good relationships with players. I guess it's not just a thing that a coach is interested in. All players are interested in it, captains are interested in it, but building good relationship with your teammates, with other players. So I wanted to sort of give a quick overview of the ideas behind it, of those soft skills, of why it's important to build relationship with players, and especially when you have people who don't necessarily want to build a relationship with you, but you have to do something. So that would be quite interesting to have a head scratch over that. So what do you think about that, Gareth? Why is it important to build relationship, good relationships with players?
Well, I think it's really important because otherwise it's going to be very difficult for you to have a foothold in the team or to influence people in a positive fashion. So I look at things very much from the outcome backwards. And if I look at outcomes, I've probably been able to help people reach their goals better if I've understood them and if I'm able to communicate with them on a regular basis and in a fairly easy fashion rather than it always being a bit awkward. So both people, whether it be the coach or the player, obviously want to improve their game and ultimately improve the team's performance if you're part of a team. And unless you've got good communication going in and out of that relationship, then you're probably not going to reach the outcome that you want to in the end. So to me, it's all about where we get to, really, and one of those key things is communication.
It doesn't always go according to plan, though, does it, Lever? So there can be a myriad of reasons why you don't have the best communication with a player. So when you get in a situation like that, what's your approach to improving a relationship with a player where it's not quite working the way that you want it to?
It's difficult sometimes because often you may not even be able to put your finger on why it is, and it may be something that was misinterpreted or something that didn't actually happen, but something that was passed on or a message that's gone from one person to another or whatever it might be, and because of that, someone may not get off on the right foot with you, and because of that, it might spiral and become something that doesn't fit really. But it's quite really important to be pretty open with people, and if you feel like a relationship needs a bit of attention and you feel that in doing that, then that's going to make an improvement, then go and speak to them about it and say that, look, what we're doing at the moment isn't maximising my time or your time, and as a result, your improvements aren't as good as they could be. And it may be that you can actually identify the root cause of where it's come from quite quickly. And it may be that it's something and nothing, really. It's almost like when you're trying to coach something technical from a player. And Gareth uses that word root cause quite a lot. And he's looking for the thing that is instigating the problem. And it might be that the conversation with the player, you can again go and identify that.
I think it's really important to have a relationship. Otherwise, sometimes you get a really good coaching point, don't you? And if you've got a brilliant relationship with somebody and you've stumbled across this coaching point, you find a way for making that lock to that person, and then they can work with it. Whereas if you haven't got that relationship with somebody, you might have the best bit of coaching advice that they'll ever get. But because the relationship isn't strong enough or good enough or clean enough, often that message then doesn't hit home, and that's a massive shame, both to the frustration of the coach, but also you'll never quite know where you can get that player to unless you can communicate. So without that relationship, it makes it very difficult. And I've had very, very good players in the past, a long time ago, admittedly, who I didn't have the relationship with, and as a result, their experience, my experience, and the team's experience, it probably was never optimised. Whereas I've had lesser players who I've had good relationships with, who we've achieved great things together because our starting point has been every good bit of information that I had, I could get across to them, just because we got on okay, we understood where each other was coming from, and we were able to initiate a positive outcome.
So is it possible, do you think, that you can have someone where you don't necessarily click with them? There's not someone you necessarily want to go and have a drink with and spend time with socially, but you can still have a good coaching relationship with them?
Very much so, yeah. And I'd suggest that in many of the coaching relationships that Sam and myself have now, purely because the fact that we're working at a school, that we wouldn't be, it wouldn't be deemed appropriate to be a friend of somebody, and it's not the right thing to do. And we have a saying here, and I'm sure it's very similar in Sam's school, that it's good to be friendly with somebody, but not necessarily to be a friend, because obviously it's a teacher or a coach relationship within a school environment, and with safeguarding and all of those things which are vitally important. It's crucial that we don't have that type of relationship where it becomes a matey one, really. So yeah, I'm probably in an experience now where I don't get the opportunity to go out with the guys and girls that we're working with in a social environment. Whereas when I was working with England and Somerset and others, that would happen on a more regular basis. So yes, very much so. And it's about keeping the appropriate distance from those players. And I think if I was to go back into an international environment now, even though you're on tour with them, I probably would have a slightly bigger gap of distance from a social perspective with the players that I was working with, more so than I had when I was working with England and Ireland, 4 or 5 years ago.
Have you ever been in a situation, Gareth, where there is someone that doesn't click with you or doesn't get on with you, but there still is the level of respect there, which means that they're still willing to take the information on, they're still willing to utilise you, but you can see there's a level of almost kind of a frostiness there that isn't going to mean you're particularly friendly to each other. However, there is that understanding and awareness that this guy's going to make me a better cricketer.
Yeah, a couple of times I've had that. And I'd say it's rare. It probably, you either go into that polarised place where you do have that relationship where it clicks, or you don't have that relationship where it makes it very difficult to affect their performance in a positive fashion. But a couple of times I had it, and I should imagine probably around Andrew Flintoff would be an example of that. Wasn't an easy person to coach, and our relationship wasn't bad. It wasn't overly brilliant, but it was, we weren't going to go out for a beer together, as we talked about earlier. But equally, we could have some good conversations around cricket, and he would challenge a lot of what I said, but occasionally something would go in and make a difference. And Andy Caddick would have been another one at Somerset. We managed to encourage him to pitch the ball up further in the latter stage of his career, so he didn't have to bowl as many balls to get his wickets. But yet again, I probably wouldn't be somebody that would jump at the opportunity to have a beer with Caddy. Yet we did manage to get to a position where it affected the way that he bowled in a positive fashion. So, but it is rare that that happens, I think, or more rare than it probably should be.
I think when you don't get on with someone, then often that bleeds over into thinking, giving them less, you know, chance to gain your respect, I suppose. Because I was talking to a player last night, actually, regarding a coach that he had, and I won't repeat what he said about the coach, but it was very clear from his language that they didn't get on, let's put it that way. But he was looking then for opportunities to not listen to the coaching advice that the coach was giving him, because he felt he was not a person that he wanted to spend any time with. In fact, it was worse than that. He didn't want to, you know, he actively didn't like him. And then so he was coming up with, from that not liking him, he was coming up with ways to not listening to the coaching advice he was giving. So I guess that's a more common situation, isn't it?
It is, and that's an emotive response around like or dislike, isn't it? That then informs whether somebody is worth listening to or not. And some people make their decisions based on emotion a lot easier than others. So for me, I couldn't really give a monkey's whether I like somebody or not. To me, it's about, has this person got information that could be really useful to me? And if that is the case, then I'll listen to them. Whether I look at them and think, oh, I'd like to go, you know, that bloke to be my friend or not, is largely irrelevant. Where other people, it becomes really important, and where trust and like often indicate whether you're going to listen to somebody's advice. So I think what you need to do in that context, if you've got somebody who's emotionally making a decision that they don't want to listen to you, you've got to present things in a way that you outline that actually we might not be best of mates, but the reason why I'm saying this is that I think it could get better for you. This could help you get better as a bowler or a batter. These are the reasons why, and I'd like to help you to achieve X, Y, and Z as a result of doing these drills or of thinking differently or whatever. Present it like that, and then it's their choice whether they choose to take on that information, irrespective of whether they like you or not. And I think if I look back, I've had one horrific coaching situation with a player where he obviously didn't like me, and as a result did everything that he possibly could to not listen or not do anything positively. And I think if I was to go back over that situation again, I'd have presented information saying, it's fine, I don't mind you not liking me. However, I think this and this can have a really positive effect on your career. And I'm sure I'd have had a better, or at least some respect would have gone between the two of us, whereas there was none whatsoever. And we had to manage a pretty tough situation around it to get the best out of the team.
From the player's perspective there as well, it's probably quite important that they're aware and that they understand that it's unlikely that everything you say is not going to help them. There's going to be, it might not be that if you come up with 10 ideas, it might be that 10 ideas, not all of them are going to have a positive impact. But if they do at least listen and they stay involved in the conversation and the process, it might be there's one thing in there that's going to help, or two or three, or whatever it is. So if you can keep them engaged in the process, even if, as Gareth says there, they're not don't have to be friendly, don't have to be get on particularly well. But it's unlikely that everything a coach says, and this can probably pass for almost any coach working out there, it's unlikely that they're going to have nothing positive to say. So regardless of the situation, listening should be the bare minimum, really.
Okay, let's move on to the yes-no round, finish up this section. And that is three questions that can only be answered yes or no, no matter how much more the team want to say. I've got the questions, so let's get started. First question. DRS makes the game fairer, but costs in entertainment.
No.
No.
Second question. The more you play stronger opposition, the more you improve.
Yes.
Yes.
Third question. It's harder coaching the best to be better than beginners.
Yes.
No.
Okay, let's answer a couple of questions now. The difference between the questions we were talking about at the beginning of the show and these ones are these questions have been sent in by listeners to the show, and they've got a burning question about cricket and they want to know the answer. And so we are going to do our best to come to the rescue. And whether we do that or not, we do offer an incentive of a prize for the best question of an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. You can find out more by going over to our website, and you can send in your questions to us by emailing coach@pitchvision.com. And that's what Afaf has done. And Afaf says, How can I lose my weight to play cricket? Is there any diet plan or exercise? It's kind of a big topic. Let's have a dig around and see what we can come up with here.
There are ways in which he can improve himself physically, and that can be through a diet plan or exercise. But more often than not, it's going to be a combination of the two, and finding something that is going to be taking him towards his goals. So the first thing we need to do really is identify what the goals are he's looking to achieve. So whether it is something that's measurable in performance or something that's measurable physically, in terms of weight or body size or whatever it might be, then you need to work out what it is you're working towards so you can gauge the success you're having along the way. So first of all, set those goals out for yourselves. It's great really as a cricketer if you can try and make some of those goals performance-based to a degree. So it might be that you want to be able to run a certain distance in a certain time or do a repeated number of sprints or any kind of strength work, whatever it could be, that's going to be relevant to the activity or the performance that you're going to have coming up in the future. So that's a kind of starting point. Prioritise here is losing weight. So when you say losing weight, why is it that you want to lose weight? Is it you want to lose weight because you want to be able to move better in the field? In which case, let's not just measure the loss of weight. Let's measure the ability to move better in the field. So make sure that that goal we're working towards is specifically the one we want to improve. And we're not maybe looking at improving one thing. Actually, we could be focusing in a slightly different area. On the weight loss side of things, it's always a combination. Generally, you'll find that diet is probably going to be a little bit more influential than the physical activity you do. So it's probably going to be about a 60-40 split from diet to exercise. Some people will say it's even more. So some people will say diet can contribute up to 75% or beyond. But I would say probably 60-40 is fair enough. In terms of how you adapt your diet and how you adapt your physical activity, ideally it's got to be something that's enjoyable, and it's also got to be something that's relevant to you and the time scales you've got, the time you've got available and the life that you're leading at the moment. So don't try and think I've got to go from one extreme to another in a day. Let's try and have some time scales on here that are going to be suited to you. So we got to try and make some small changes over the first 4 weeks, and that could be cutting a few things out of a diet that maybe aren't necessarily helping, and it could be adding in a couple of physical activity sessions during a week that are going to have a positive effect. So taking out a couple of negatives, adding a couple of positives in between, that should have a positive effect. And then as you go along, you can start to build up your knowledge of the foods you're eating. You can start to build up the knowledge of the physical activity and how you wanted to pinpoint the performances you want to improve, and as you go along, you'll start to see the results, hopefully, on the pitch in whatever role you're playing. But back to the start really is work out exactly what it is you want to do and why it is you want to do it, and then look to try and combine the two aspects as best you can.
It strikes me, Gareth, that and you have to tell me how you do this at Millfield. It strikes me that weight is relatively low on the scale of importance when it comes to being a cricketer, but when it becomes a problem, then it is a problem, and you have to look at it then. So, when do you get to the point at the school where you feel like, okay, the fitness of this person is affecting their ability to play cricket at the level that they want to play?
Quite early, actually, because It is going to have a massively detrimental effect on the way that they'll, how far they can go in the pathway. And there's two reasons for that. One, there is going to be a performance drop off, particularly around areas of fatigue. If you're having to shift as much of the body as you've got, and you should have less of it, obviously to shift the body that you've got is going to take more energy, and as a result you're going to fatigue at a quicker rate. But also I think perception is a massive thing in the way that people make decisions, and we can't get away from that. And every time a sport is professionalised or new money comes into it, and there's more money in cricket now than there ever has been in terms of what a player can earn, the expectation, the first expectation that changes is what the physical demands of that sport become. And we're just about to see it within the women's game now, particularly in England, where there's been a lot of investment now into this city cricket and central contracts. The first thing that you always see change is the physicality of the players. There's a professionalism that goes around it and an expectation that goes around somebody looking the business as well as being able to play the game as well. So from our point of view, the educational process starts when they walk in the door here. If we have a player who is struggling with weight has got a bit of a history of being a bit bigger and maybe picking up some niggles as a result, or not performing as well as a result, then the first thing that I would do with them always is to get them to actually log what they do. Because we've got to get a starting point and awareness around their calories that they take on board, and also the calories that they shift through exercise and activity. And there's some brilliant ways of doing that now. And one of my favourite bits of kit is MyFitnessPal, which is an app which you can get on your phone. It's also on the internet as well, which is absolutely magnificent, where you can log your food intake. And not only does it also do your calories, but it also breaks the food down into all of the different components, including salt and sugar, which is obviously very topical nowadays. And it gives you feedback on the end of each week about what you're putting into your system and what you're not putting in. Proteins become incredibly important in the world now of sport, and it logs all of that. You can even take a picture of the plate of food that you've got in front of you, and it will give a fairly basic but a useful synopsis of what's actually in the food that you're eating, and it gives you really good feedback based on that. You can also log all of your fitness results, and if you're lucky enough to have a fitness watch or a monitor which logs your steps or whatever, you can link that into it, and basically it does that to and fro and calculates whether what you're doing is good, and also how you can sharpen your performance both in what you eat and also what your outputs are as well. But that starting point of logging what you're doing, what you're eating, what you're expending is the big one for me, because it builds awareness. And if you've got awareness, then you can then make decisions off the back of it.
Yeah, I think that's brilliant, logging that. If you've got a problem and you can't quite work out what's going wrong, then logging for a while, you don't have to even do it for very long, do you? I mean, you can do it temporarily until you sort of get to the bottom of what's happening, and then, you know, perhaps, well, you make any changes to see what difference it makes. But it's not something you're going to have to do for the rest of your life. You can do it for a set time period until you've locked in some new habits and you feel like you're going in the direction you want to go in. So I think that's a very powerful tool, that logging tool. It is a bit of work, you know, logging things and making sure that everything is tracked exactly as it happened and not as you would perhaps you would like it to happen, which is always very tempting to do.
Yeah.
But if you can overcome those challenges, then the results you get off the back of it will reveal things to you, and you'll be able to get to where you want to be more quickly. So that's a really powerful tip, I think, Gareth.
Yeah, definitely. And obviously a bit, you know, something like MyFitnessPal, and there's loads of others out there. You just have to search the app stores to pick those up. But even if you haven't got access to that, and it's writing it down in a diary, just putting that sort of information down will give you a really good synopsis of where you're actually at. And then off the back of that, you can make some informed decisions rather than some sort of like speculative ones that you can quite easily fall off of those habits that you're looking to develop.
I don't know if you've seen this show. There's a show called Secret Eaters. Has anyone seen
it? I've heard of it. I've not seen it.
Yeah.
I've been subjected to it a few times. It's not through my own choice, but it's. I'll be honest, it's pretty painful viewing. However, one of the things that seems pretty clear, and a lot of people is that their education on the understanding when it comes to the foods they're eating is pretty poor, and there are some people on there who very much swear they can't understand why they're putting on the weight, they can't understand why they're shaped they're in, and they eat quite a normal kind of diet, but some of them are drinking kind of 3 to 4 liters of fizzy drinks a day, and as a result of that, their relatively normal diet of food is being kind of trebled just in the fluid intake that they're having, and people just appear to not be aware that fizzy drinks are full of things that aren't necessarily good for you.
Yeah.
So sometimes by using an app like Gareth has said, it might just identify the people. Actually, this seems obvious now. I didn't realise that donuts weren't healthy, or whatever it might be. You never know what it might be, but you get the idea. A little bit of education that an app like that can give you could be a massive shift in not only in your lifestyle but also your performance.
Coffee's another one of those that people don't quite realize. You go, like, well, a cup of coffee, that's all right, but you know, if you put in cream in it, or you get the squirty cream on the top, and they put in the syrups into it, and you know, before you know it, you've got 500 calories in your cup of coffee. So there are ways to secretly eat and not even realize you're doing it.
No, exactly right. So yeah, awareness, I think, is always a starting point. And we've had a couple of guys that have come from UAE into school, and one of them has really embraced this. And it's fantastic to see the physical gains, but also the self-confidence gains that he's picking up. He's only been with us for a few weeks, but just the way he carries himself around school now, it's wonderful to see. And that's come off the back of him logging what he puts into his system and also his outputs as well.
And next question is from Kaupner. And Kaupner says, how do you go about setting a field as a right-hand leg spinner bowling in the middle overs of a 50-over game with the main intent to take wickets, as well as restricting runs against attacking batsmen?
Well, there's heaps of things that we have to take into consideration, because we know that there are different types of leg spinners. We know that there are different types of conditions and different types of players of leg spin. All of those things need to be taken into consideration until... even before you work out your boundary lengths, which way the wind's blowing, and all of those various different things. So I'm going to strip it back to, you know, almost a pen and paper exercise, another one, where we look at what field you could have. And a real basic one, if you're looking to take wickets and you're looking to defend at the same time, is to have your deep cover out, which is one of the most crucial positions, and we actually see it in test match cricket a lot. We've seen it in this test series between England and Pakistan out in the UAE, where Rashid and the other leg spinner for Pakistan have been bowling with a deep cover or a deep point out there, just to stop the boundary and to mean that the best shot only goes for one, and that's in a test match environment. So I'd always have a deep cover if we're looking to take wickets and we're looking to restrict runs at the same time. I'd always have a guy back on the sweep, but that would be my starting point. And if I've got somebody who doesn't sweep deep backward square, then we've got the option of bringing that guy up. And those are my mainstay too, to be honest. And then after that, we have to look at how the pitch is playing, how the batter's playing. I think people put two men back straight far too early nowadays, and I'd like to encourage my leg spinner to risk being hit over the top once and maybe twice. Or if I do it, then I'll put deep mid off back if it's to a right-handed batter, and keep mid on up and entice a batter to try and hoy it over the top of mid on, because then that deep mid off can come into play. But they would be my three main deep fielders. But even then, I'd probably keep deep mid off up to start off with. Slip generally is a really good one for a leg spinner to keep in, and if there's anything in the pitch, then I'd encourage the leg spinner to maintain that slip for as long as they possibly can. Obviously, situations change. A batter might be in, he might have a fantastic game against leg spin, but I'd keep that guy in as best as possible. And the other attacking option that I would have would be maybe to have a deep cow fielder, but leave a gap at straight mid-wicket and in mid-wicket. So you're asking somebody as a right-hander to push the ball into a vacant leg side, If a ball's gripping a bit, then that leading edge can come into play. You can get stumpings out of it where people are trying to deliberately push a ball they shouldn't be into the leg side and then they topple over. Or we get an edge to that slip fielder. So those would be my main attacking and defensive options, but keep a slip in as much as you can. If you don't have that straight mid wicket on the one, then you've got the option of putting that guy on the drive on the offside as well, which brings another catching fielder into play. But it's about balancing where those deep fielders are up against your catches, because a leg spinner is less easy to rotate for ones and singles than he is to either hit for four or to play defensively too. So I would always try and defend against a hit for four, attack against a defensive shot, but I wouldn't be so bothered on the wicket that grips whether people are trying to rotate the strike, because if they're rotating the strike, then there's a fairly good chance that they'll be playing across the line of a ball, and then that slip comes into play, the stumping comes into play, and maybe even a caught and bowled.
Lavers, first of all, have you got anything to add to that? That was very comprehensive. Thanks, Gareth. But Lavers, have you got anything to add to that? And second of all, if you haven't got anything to add to that, or even if you have, but if you haven't, where would you like to place your best fielders in a situation that we're talking about here?
Okay, firstly, that's pretty much, it's fairly comprehensive from Gareth there. I think we had a question similar to this about probably 6 months ago or so, and we did talk about how we'd structure that field and the infield and the outfield. And as Gareth said there, it is the manipulation of the ball is a lot trickier against the leg spinner. Obviously, a lot of this is thinking against right-handers, and if we were to bring a left-hander into play, then things might be slightly different with the ball turning back into the pads, and that manipulation of the ball into the leg side would be slightly easier. But with right-handed batters, that's pretty conclusive. If you then look at key fielders, again, the game situation is going to be relevant. And a lot of people have watched 2020 over the last 3-4 years, and they've seen the shift of fielders that move from key positions in field to key positions in the deep. At a certain point in the game where they feel that shift of players occurred. If we're in the mid-innings of a 50-over game here and we're thinking that we want our key people in play to take wickets, then our key people are going to be those people who are under a catch somewhere or possibly in a key position for a run-out. So slip's obviously going to be a vital one. So there's no point having a slip in there if he's not going to take 8-9 out of 10 chances, really. So if he's a 50-50 man, you're probably looking at either putting him somewhere else and having someone else in the slips or not having the slip at all. But that's something we want to try and keep in if we can. Apart from that, you've got to think about your high traffic areas and your wicket-taking areas. So as Gareth said there, that guy at Cow can often be a really good wicket-taking option if pressure's built up and they feel like they have to play a big shot. So that could be a wicket-taking area. And then the high-traffic areas of repetition in defence are likely to be those extra cover fielders, so someone in around there, and possibly the guy at backward point, depending on how much the pitch is actually going to turn. And he might just squirt away towards kind of square cover point area again. Beyond that, again, horses for courses. You're putting your athletes in the right position. You're putting your people who maybe aren't as strong in other positions. So cover boundary probably gets quite a lot of service, even though it's not necessarily going to be a lot of the traffic out there will probably be fairly simple to deal with. So a lot of the time it will be a ball rolled out there for one. It might be that there's the odd instance where it's saving twos and sliding on the boundaries, but that's going to be quite a key position, really. And then you've got to have a couple of places, because most teams are trying to hide one or two. So you then need to work out where the least important places are going to be, and if you do have an opportunity to hide someone, where can you hide someone? Again, it's going to be pitch dependent on the pace of the pitch, the turn of the pitch, of where you can put that person, and also the batter concern. So a lot of the time that person might find themselves at 45, but depending on the pitch and the way the player's playing, if it's turning a long way and someone's bowling out into the rough and that sweep is an option, you might actually want to put a great fielder in there. So hiding people's never particularly easy. And ideally, we'd work more the other way and try and make sure everyone's equipped to field wherever they can.
This week on the Soapbox, which is 60 seconds on the clock and an uninterrupted word from one of the members of the team, it's Mark Garraway. So, Gareth, over to you.
I had a fascinating conversation with a young man today who joined one of our fast bowling groups. He's a pretty good bowler. In fact, he's an international bowler. And he pitched up, and it was noticeable that his intensity wasn't particularly strong today. So I quizzed him on it later in the day, actually, but as he came in for a lesson in period one today. And I asked him to assess his intensity and said between zero being none whatsoever and 10 being you're absolutely all over it. And he came back with two. So I asked him why it was two. And he said, well, because he was tired, because it was early in the morning. And then I asked him if it would be appropriate, because I'm tired at the moment, whether I behaved in a similar way and didn't put any effort into his coaching session that we were about to work into. And he told me that no, that wouldn't be appropriate because I need to be professional. And I said, well, that's good, because I am going to be professional in our session. But, you know, could you have applied yourself differently in the session that we had? And then I explained to him that it's really important that when you get tired, that's when you actually put more intensity into something, because it's a choice. And if you have a choice between not doing it and doing it, you actually learn more from doing it when you're feeling tired or hungry or you don't really want to be there. If you can find a way through that, then that's going to make a difference. And when you play in international cricket, as I said to him, in 10 years' time, and the England captain chucks you the cricket ball in Abu Dhabi when it's 35 degrees and says, get me two wickets, instead of making the choice to just go through the motions, you'll do something different, and that'll change your career, and that'll change the way that everybody looks at you. So that was my story from this morning. I hope that there's some relevance in it. And that's it for this week.
And that is the end of the show for another week. Before we go, though, we do need to decide on the winner of the competition. If you remember from earlier on, we had two questions, and one of those is going to win a prize, an online coaching course from Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And the two questions were Afaf's question about losing weight and Kalpman's question about setting a field for a leg spinner in 50-over cricket. Which one did you prefer this week, Gareth?
I like the weight one, actually. We get loads of questions about weight, but we also get loads of questions about setting fields, don't we? And I think it's been a bit longer since we had the weight question. I think that Sam came out with some fantastic things. I knew he would, because he's a bit of a legend in that area, even though he doesn't say so himself. And then just some practical things as well around the analysing of your own performance, both in your intake and your output. So yeah, I'm going to go for that one this week.
Excellent. Congratulations to you, Effa. And if someone was listening to the show and they wanted to send their question in and have their chance to win that prize, how could they get in touch with us?
They could give us a call, David, on 0203 239 7543 or drop us an email on coach@pitchvision.com.
That is correct. And you can also get us via social media. Our Facebook is facebook.com/pitchvisionacademy and our Twitter is @pitchvisionacad. You can also find us lurking around on Google+ as well for a few people that are still hanging out over there. You can also listen to the show every week if you do a search in your favourite podcast app for Pitch Vision Academy. You'll find us under there. Just tap the subscribe button and you'll get that into your podcatching app every week. And if you want to do it a bit more manually, you can go over to the Pitch Vision website, pitchvision.com/academy, and click on the podcast link in the sidebar and you'll have all the show notes in there. You'll be able to stream the show directly from the webpage if you're into doing that, and you can also download old shows directly from that page as well, all the way back to episode one. But that's all for this week. We hope you listen next week, but until then, have a good week. Cheers, Gareth. Cheers, Lavers.
Cheers, fellas.